This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Rest is Entertainment with me, Marina Hyde.
And me, Richard Osman. Hello, everybody. Hello, Marina.
Hello, Richard. It's the morning after the Oscars.
It is the morning after the Oscars. Once again, we came away empty-handed.
Yes, but we won in many ways because if you live in this country, you don't actually have to watch the ceremony as live. You can just watch it in the morning. You get all the clips, all the red carpet, and you think, oh yeah, no, I've covered this one off. But you don't have to sit through all the tedium, and there is a huge amount in it.
The way all British people experience the Oscars is just watching Ross King on Good Morning Britain.
It was actually shorter than expected, though, the Oscar ceremony, because Al Pacino cocked up the announcement of Best Picture, which went to Oppenheimer, and he opened the envelope, and instead of reading out all the 10 nominees for Best Pictures, just cut straight to this chase by saying, "My eyes see Oppenheimer."
My eyes see Oppenheimer.
Which is not...
It sounds like when they say, do you know what the shortest verse in the Bible is? It is, "My eyes see Oppenheimer."
It does not sound like Al Pacino dialogue. Like, well done, you have got one job. It's not really that long ago that they announced La La Land instead of Moonlight.
Yeah.
You know, PricewaterhouseCoopers audits the Oscars.
Do you know what? I knew we'd get onto PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Sorry, Coopers. Yeah, this is a show,
I didn't think we'd get onto them
this
quickly.
I mean, I have to say, they've got one job.
You know this, like, the rest is money currently are talking about the cinematography.
Yeah,
and
they
we're
are.
Talking
They're
about PricewaterhouseCoopers.
They're doing the red carpet and the surgery, which we'll come on to.
Also, Al Pacino's been to an awful lot of award ceremonies.
Mm.
I mean, you must understand the sort of grammar of an award ceremony. They don't just open it and go, "My eyes see Oppenheimer." Because like, everyone in the audience just went, "Oh, sorry.
Can I just say he's a new dad, Richard, at age 82 or 83 or whatever he is. He's just had a baby.
Congratulations, Al.
4 years younger than him. And so, you know, it's possible that those late nights doing the nappies, diapers, as they say in America, are taking away some of his focus.
Or perhaps he's AI Pacino. That would work written down. Yeah. Written down, that's actually not
written
a bad
down,
joke.
That is.
Now I say it out loud.
Yeah,
it needs very poor indeed. it was good in a way that he did make that slight gaffe, because there were no gaffes, really, which makes the ceremony less fun.
And you need them. And also, it made the point even clearer that we knew all the way in that this was going, right from the start of award ceremonies, which is a month ago, that this was sort of going to be a coronation for Christopher Nolan and for Oppenheimer. And whether or not you think it's Christopher Nolan's best film, there is much more to the Academy these days where they feel that, oh dear, there's someone who's really, really big, who people sort of credit with getting people back to the cinemas after the pandemic, and who hasn't got an Oscar. Now, in the old days, they were very relaxed about not giving people Oscars. Howard Hawks never got an Oscar. Alfred Hitchcock never got an Oscar. You know, Garbo never got one. Dietrich, Fred Astaire, all these kind of great big...
Tom Cruise.
No, he has had an Oscar, hasn't he?
Tom Cruise?
Did he not get it for Born on the 4th of July?
Oh, yeah, you could
Sorry,
be right. I'm thinking of Jason Statham.
Yeah, you're thinking of Statham. Anyhow, you need that. You kind of need some viral moment, and they didn't have a lot of those, I must say. The red carpet, to me, it's almost like it's a sort of Leni Riefenstahl event now. It is so organised, and the combination between the big fashion brands, there's two great big nights of the year for fashion, the Oscars and the Met Gala.
I thought you were going to say the TV Quick Awards.
Not the TV Quick Awards, but I'm sure that they do count. But even for something like the Golden Globes, those agencies that run kind of metrics and impact and whatever say that just the red carpet of that is worth about $90 million to the fashion brands. And so if you're a really big fashion brand and your stuff is out there, like, I don't know, like Louis Vuitton, Emma Stone and Davine Joy Randolph, who were both in Louis Vuitton. So this is a big deal.
So Louis Vuitton's the real winner.
Louis Vuitton is the real winner. But everyone gets contracts, you get paid. And all the brands say, we don't pay people to wear the dresses. And all the brands do. And they might try and say, oh, they were doing some promotional work or whatever. But you can get paid. We're talking about like non-Oscars ceremonies. You can get paid tens of thousands. You might get paid up to $250,000 to wear a dress. And in some very rare cases, I saw a great fashion expert, Lauren Sherman, discussing this week, you can get $1 million for one night wearing a dress.
Wow.
And
what,
they
me?
Will all deny.
I can't, hold on. give me details about how I can get 1 million
because you will
for
do
one
it.
Night wearing a dress.
I think we all would. But
oh
anyway.
My God, I'd do it. But it's the other interesting thing, because for years the thing on Twitter was stop asking actresses what designer they're wearing. You think, oh no, that's part of their contract.
Believe me, they want you to ask, because if they don't get asked, they're going to go along. And the red carpet as well, which people, I noticed this year, the way they shot the red carpet and the way they did the sort of wide shots, they didn't do like a big wide shot. So you'd see, a lot of people think with red carpets, oh, there's just a small red carpet outside the thing and everyone walks past and gets photographed in front of the statue or whatever. Sometimes they are absolutely enormous and they're quite far from the venue. In the Kodak Theatre, that's a different thing. It's the Oscars and they try and make it a bit more like, you know, as live and how it actually is. But it is enormous, this thing. It goes on for absolutely miles and it is a place of absolute military efficiency and they are shouted at. And then, you know, you're in this awful situation when you're a photographer and you think, yeah, I don't want your husband in it, actually. So they have to shout out, can we have one just for fashion? And that is the trade euphemism for get your husband out of the picture because nobody cares about him.
One for fashion. There's a, if you ever go to like premieres and things like that, which I very rarely do, but sometimes, you know, something will crop up and there'll be, as you say, there'll be like a red carpet and say you turn up at the red carpet, but the red carpet has like about four different lanes on it.
Yeah.
And like you go, hold on, I'm in lane four. And there's no photographers in lane four, so they have a red carpet, but it's really very carefully segregated. You think, I don't appear to be walking down the same path as Hugh Grant. Is that...
happened here?
Which one of us is in the A-list here?
But they want to put you, and they also want... The big stars want to turn up at the very end because they don't want to have to, you know, turn up at sort of 3 p.m. and go really, really slowly down it and then have to sit in their seat for even longer than they would wish to. One of the big stories on the red carpet this year is Ozempic.
Yes, Ozempic is the real winner. It was even advertised during the Oscars, I think.
That's really interesting.
Which is quite on the nose.
Eli Lilly, who do a version of a semaglutide drug, a weight loss drug, and they actually advertised in the week beforehand, rather sort of finger-wagging advert, saying it's really bad that people are using this to get into a dress, which seemed really like, okay, I guess you're talking about Hollywood a few days out from the Oscars. So they've attempted to have their cake and eat it, have they, by having an advert there?
Apparently,
the food at these parties is now just completely left. You would have thought that that would have always been the case, but apparently it wasn't. Having starved themselves to get into these dresses for you know, weeks and months in many cases, the food at the parties afterwards was always very well consumed. I remember, I think Graydon Carter said, when I did the Vanity Fair party, he said, I always had the starters on the plates. You arrive and you get there and you sit down and your starter's already on your plate because people are really hungry.
There's a great article about Ozempic last week and it was talking about the effect it's had on Hollywood. Because a lot of them are on it.
Yeah.
Okay, let's name names, but a lot of them are taking...
Just assume everyone's on it, by the way.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Much easier to assume everyone's
but
on it.
But it's saying the restaurant business in Hollywood is genuinely struggling.
Yeah, nobody's eating dinner.
People are not hungry anymore. It was talking about like makeup artists, but saying there's people's faces are really changing shape. The job we're having to do is slightly different. The people who loved it were the fashion designers
who believe that you can never be too. I'm not suggesting that I think you can never be too thin, but the fashion designers think this is great. Everyone fits into our sample sizes, and this is a lot easier for us.
And the personal trainers were saying we have to literally the first 15 minutes of most sessions is somebody upstairs throwing up. But it's like an epidemic over there, right?
Yeah. I think the first big one was when, for the Met Gala, when Kim Kardashian wore that dress that Marilyn Monroe had sang Happy Birthday to JFK in, and she had lost a massive amount of weight, even though she doesn't have a whole lot at all to lose, to get into this thing. And she did some extraordinary series of interviews about, you know, I had to be so disciplined eating my steamed fish and vegetables. You know, my feelings about the steamed fish and vegetable idea, it passes for conversation from a celebrity. But she gave so many of these interviews, it's like, yeah, no, you can't in 3 weeks lose what you did. So I think she was the real kind of canary in the coal mine for it. And people thinking, oh my God, what is this thing?
Jockeys used to give themselves tapeworms.
Yeah.
That's what
Mariah Callas did that. I think she swallowed about 5 in her life.
No, yeah. Did she?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So listen, Ozempic is very much the new tapeworm.
Yeah. Yes. Like everything's always one up from leeches, isn't it? But
do you know what? The one thing I will say, no gaffes or anything like that. It felt like a proper old-fashioned big movie night. And the movie industry's been through some terrible times. It's got more terrible times to come, I'm sure. But it felt like you've got Oppenheimer, you've got Barbie, you've got some great supporting films. You've got like American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall. Like proper movies out there.
But it's unusual, I think, that people had seen Barbie and they'd seen Oppenheimer. And I have to say, in the last few years, you're looking at the Best Picture list and nobody's gone to the multiplex to see these things. You know, I'm not saying they haven't kind of made money, but they're on smaller budgets and they're not the mainstream of what people go and see. But they've had a very great thing for themselves this year with the Academy because people had seen $2 billion movies. But I think this is a blip.
Oh, do you think so? This will be, we'll look back on this and like next year we'll be back to Kung Fu Panda 4. We'll be...
Well, it does. None of those films get nominated. So you've got this two-track thing where you've got the awards films, which people like for prestige and more, like we were talking about things like Saudi money. You'll see that kind of money backing those kind of prestige features, but people don't throng to see, essentially. Then you have movies which are popular, which might be superhero franchise or things based on video games or whatever it is, but they never get nominated. And I think that they've been really lucky with that this year where people have seen, so many people have seen two of the mega, and they happened the same weekend, there with the Barbenheimer phenomenon. People have seen those films and that counts for something because it makes people feel like this isn't some kind of weird self-indulgent thing that, I mean, it is kind of weird self-indulgent thing, like all award ceremonies, but it's not something that is so...
By the way,
removed.
Congratulations on your podcast of the year nomination. Talking about award ceremonies.
We are nominated.
Yeah, Broadcasting Press. So that's, I know that you won't be going because you don't approve of that sort of thing, but we are going to have a great old time. Anyway, that aside, now you say it's a blip, but I wonder, I mean, the one thing you know about Hollywood is the one thing that attracts money is what worked last. What was the last thing to work? Let's do that again. And you would hope maybe the success of Oppenheimer means that there are projects that wouldn't have got greenlit, say, 2 years ago, which now will get greenlit. So maybe, don't do that
face. I don't know. I mean, actually, Cord Jefferson, who won Best Adapted Screenplay for American Fiction, which is absolutely terrific, he said something quite good in his speech on that, which was quite sort of political for within the town, as it were. He said, you know, a lot of people passed on this movie, so many people passed on this movie, and I'm really glad it got made. But, you know, just don't forget that a $200 million tentpole is also a risk. And instead of making $200 million tentpoles, how about you make 20 $10 million films? And it got a huge round of applause because I guess people, in lots of ways, people wish that, they suddenly might find it more interesting as a project, as an actor, to be involved in those type of films than basically doing a great big green screen superhero performance, which has kind of eaten the market. If that could happen, that might be exciting. And yet it takes a long time for the supertanker to turn around. And they have essentially bet the farm on these kind of slates where everything is propped up by superhero or video game franchise, or maybe now after Barbie toy franchises.
Or people who make nuclear reactors.
Maybe. But Christopher Nolan is a sort of category of one, isn't he?
Yeah.
And those are very expensive films. And people believe that there's something about him that can make kind of high art that, whether or not you think it's high art, but it can make something that they regard as high art, and it can, you know, bring people back to cinemas after the pandemic. Tenet was really people held up as a sort of example, like, gosh, I can't believe, you know, he'll only ever do theatrical release. He's like Tom Cruise. If it doesn't have a theatrical release, he's not interested. He's not a television star.
Never won an Oscar, of course.
I'm sorry, I've just looked that up. Tom Cruise has not won. He has been nominated 4 times, but he has not won an Oscar. I don't know why I thought him, could picture him winning for Born on the 4th of July.
And I've just looked it up, and apparently Jason Statham has won. He's won 4 Oscars.
He's up there with Katharine Hepburn. In so many ways.
I thought it was hosted by either Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon. I can never remember which. But I thought it did a great job. Like, yes. Nice gags, like proper, again, just an absolute safe pair of hands, which is what you need. You think, oh, this is like proper old school, you know, Oscars from years ago. It gave me a sense of optimism. Anyway, the success of Oppenheimer, the fact that there's movies like American Fiction and Poor Things and Anatomy of a Fall, unusual movies being out there, the fact that you've got this sort of ceremony that seems to work and everyone, you know, all the stars were there and there's big new stars, you know, Cillian Murphy and Emma Stone winning and Margot Robbie there as a producer and lots of female producers winning big. I just think it gave me some optimism for that industry. And also, after 37 attempts, Godzilla finally won an Oscar. That's the big news. That finally, for like visual effects. So Godzilla finally got one as well.
Box office receipts are going to be really down this year. So I have to temper that note of optimism that you have.
That's not like you.
No, I'm a big fan of what Cord Jefferson said. And I would love to see the same money being used to make a series
more
of different films. And how many of the big tentpoles have essentially been flops for however many hundreds of millions of $5.
And also maybe make them shorter would be another note. I was thinking, so Oppenheimer, listen, it's nice that there's a big movie that you can have an opinion on. My opinion is, imagine the film it was if you lost that last hour. I just think, like, you in Eurovision Song Contest, you can't go over 3 minutes. And I would say 2 hours 15. If your film is longer than 2 hours 15 minutes, you stop it there. Stop it at 2 hours 15.
I think it should be an hour 45, and you've got to really argue that you're making an epic if it goes to 2:15.
Honestly, I was trying to, you know, be kind of liberal about it. I would 1:30. Genuinely, here's a category next year for the Oscars: best film under an hour and 45 minutes. Imagine. There'd be so many films in the edit going, if we just knock another 17 minutes off this, we could be eligible for the Oscar.
We're
nailed on. Yeah.
Yeah.
So somewhere in between best short feature and best film. I thought best picture was the Kate Middleton one. That's what I thought.
Manipulated image. We might have to. We'll see how that plays out. And yes, we may discuss this in full next week.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the Oscars: Ozempic and films that are too long.
Now,
right?
What else are we going to talk about?
I wanted to talk about Channel 5.
Yes,
if I may.
Please.
Going from Oscars to Channel 5, I want to talk specifically about their documentary output, because this weekend they have a fast turnaround documentary about the Wonkaland fiasco in Glasgow, which has entertained us all so mightily. Genuinely, I guarantee I will watch, and I genuinely guarantee that another 1.5 or 2 million people will watch as well. And it just shines a light on how brilliant Channel 5's documentaries are. There's the fast turnaround ones, which we'll talk about, but they're so amazing at putting their fingers on what people are interested in.
It's
so,
like SEO, isn't it? It really is. It's almost like...
It's like human search engine optimization.
Could we not do this really quite quickly? And the answer is yes, and particularly in the case of this Wonka one. You've got a lot of actors who either weren't paid or were... Sorry, I don't want to shame the House of Illuminati, who organised this, the Wonka Experience, who the real Illuminati are obviously far more organised. But they...
Most recently they did, I think, Al Pacino's Oscar speech.
Yes, they put that one on. They threw a great speech. Obviously, all the characters who... All the actors, either they didn't get paid or they got paid very belatedly, and... They want to talk. Everyone's kind of quite glad to have been part of it. So they're kind of the dream fast turnaround.
Exactly.
Stars.
And also, it's absolutely one of those things that we want to hear. Make that 3 hours long.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'll keep watching it. So they're doing that. They're very good at those fast turnaround ones. And by and large, they sort of give them to ITN or to Mentor. And it's
very, very
hard to turn around those shows. They did a great one on Captain Tom, Where Did the Money Go?
These are the things that people really... And I suppose what people don't often understand, and a lot of people say this to me, is like, but why couldn't you make a television programme about that? And you're like, oh my God, you know, television takes so long to make and blah, blah. But it doesn't have to. And for something like this, particularly, a lot of these people have current affairs backgrounds.
Yep.
So they're not stressed out. Some of them have... I remember reading an interview with one some years ago, and he was... It was an Oscar Pistorius documentary. Pistorius had been arrested, and because we have a different, it's not our legal system. You, even if you write stories about what had happened or make documentaries about it, you're not in contempt of court, which if he'd been being tried under British law, you would have been. So someone had said to this guy at like 4:30 on a Friday afternoon, let's have a Pistorius documentary. By Sunday morning, he was with a crew in Johannesburg.
Wow.
And all of these people they've worked in war zones, they've done all sorts of things. So they don't get stressed, and they can do fast turnaround.
Well, that's it. Well, you need two different things. You need an incredible crew of people who can do it. Exactly what you're saying. The sort of people who can be told with 24 hours notice, you've got to be in Johannesburg, but not only can shoot it, but also working out what the edit is as they go along, because you're not overshooting at all. You've got to work out exactly what your story is and get it. And then something unusual happens. You've got to sort of subsume that into your story as well. But they're brilliant at doing it, as they Mentor and ITN.
Someone said you can never have enough GVs, which is a general view. So if you're stuck, they should be shooting at all points. The second he got to Johannesburg, like, if we're not shooting, we're making a mistake. So let's get the outside, a GV, a general view of a property. So they have you have the outside of almost every possible house or property or like office or anything featured in this story. And then you're just banking stuff that you can use one way or another.
Which either you use to say to your narrative is now we're here, or you use for your edit, you drop them in. So you need that, and the people who do that, it's extraordinary how they do it. But you also need, at the channel, somebody who can say yes within 5 minutes, right, or no within 5 minutes.
This is not something that happens at the BBC.
It is not something that happens at virtually any channel, but Channel 5 are very, very good. They've got a very small team. Ben Frau runs it, he's very, very instinctive. And if you do want to make a fast turnaround documentary, you can't have a commissioner who takes a week and a half thinking about it, right?
Because you need a quick yes.
You need a quick yes. It needs to be 5 or 10 minutes, and they're set up to do that at Channel 5. You also need a channel who are happy to change their schedules at a moment's notice and to say, look, this is not going to be in the Radio Times, but, you know, we hope that the social media and stuff might, you know, promote it anyway. And they have that at Channel 5 as well. They're very happy to move their schedules around. And, you know, it really, really pays off for them. But that's incredibly rare to have a commissioner who will just, it's more like a news editor.
Yes. Right?
So a news editor has to.
Well, what they're sort of doing in many ways is what the Sunday papers do when there's a big news story of the week, and then they'll, in the news reviews, this is a sort of historic thing, but, you know, you'd have a much deeper analysis of that, and someone would have gone to the town where the by-election happened or whatever it was, and try and give you the story behind the music, as it were. And
But done very quickly.
But done, yeah.
And they're doing that for TV. But so they do those fast turnaround ones, but I think their general documentary output is also extraordinary. Talk about a channel who knows their audience. They're just about to do their fourth air fryer documentary of the year, right? All of which, by the way, have rated over 1 million. And, you know, a million
is... today's money is a lot.
Is a lot of people. That's if you're 4 or 5 on BBC Two, you kill for 1 million. They did Christmas Made Easy. That's an air fryer one. They did Air Fryers versus Microwaves was one of theirs. They did Air Fryers, Do You Know What You're Missing? Not if you've watched the previous two.
Are they in the pay of big air fryer?
And they're about to do Air Fryers, The Easy Way to Lose Weight. That's
wow.
4 within 3 months. But all of which rate. And again, because you have a commissioning team there who sort of understands what normal human beings are interested in. We've got generations of producers who make programs about what they think people should be watching, whereas Channel 5 are very happy just to make programs about what people are actually interested in.
It comes back to that SEO thing, that they almost are looking at the sort of top trends and thinking, how quickly could we do this and why haven't we done this?
But it also has to be, what's your sensibility as a human being?
Yeah.
If you wake up in the morning and think, why is everyone talking about air fryers, which I'm guessing someone like Ben Frehl does, listen, that's no judgment, I do the same, then of course you commission a documentary about air fryers. If you wake up in the morning and you're thinking about the latest Philip Roth novel, you know, you're probably not going to commission a documentary on air fryers.
You're not your viewers.
You are not your viewers, exactly right. And I think, funnily enough, I talked to a couple of people at Channel 5 about this on Friday, and they were on an away day at Hampton Court, which is the most Channel 5 thing imaginable. So they've done all those. They also do Inside the M&S Food Hall. Yes, tick,
yes.
I'm interested. They do A Day in the Life of Tesco. Yes, tick, I'm interested. They've done The Secrets of Aldi, The Secrets of Lidl. I'm interested in all of these things because that's our everyday life.
They did fall slightly foul of... when the Titanic sub went down, they did a really fast turnaround documentary. And I think that it was, I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that it was going to be on air at the time that the oxygen was scheduled to run out. As it turned out, before then, there was discovered that there'd been some debris and what have you. That was, for some, too fast a turnaround. But I think, did Dan Walker present that? And he was like, this is not a fast turnaround documentary. It's a new special.
Oh, I think they cut live, didn't they, to the press conference?
Yes.
Yes, it's interesting that. Yeah, that's somewhere in between the two, isn't it?
Well, he kept saying, this is a new special, but it had not been billed as a new special, but it became sort of... because I think that there was a little bit of backlash, the too fast turnaround, the too soon turnaround documentary.
Yes, it's like us not wanting to talk about the Kate Middleton photograph.
Yeah.
Yeah. They have amazing casting. We've talked before about Ben Fogle goes to Chernobyl and everyone's just going, oh my God, really, have they scraped the bottom of the barrel? And it's massive rating. Massive rating, because people are interested in Chernobyl and people like Ben Fogle. Even this week, Ben Fogle's in the Congo. I was watching, they had a thing called the Motorway Map of Britain, which is like the history of Britain's motorways, which I saw, again, the first 2 minutes of. And the archive was so great and the story was so great. And it talked about the birth of service stations. I watched the whole hour. You know, that's just great telly, well made, about things that people are interested in. They are very interesting. The people they have doing their documentaries, Ben Fogle, they have Alexander Armstrong.
Yes.
Inside the Royal Palaces. I started watching one of those just so I could send him like a snarky message. And I watched all the way to the end because it's brilliant. Susan Cowman, they have Nick Knowles going on trains. They have Tony Robinson going around the world on trains. Jay Blades. They got Michael Palin. You know.
Oh, yes.
They know who people want to watch.
It's really well run.
And then they send them to interesting places. Anders always off to Iceland and South Korea and so, and Iceland, the country, by the way, but they should also send him to Iceland, the shop.
Yeah.
That's a documentary. Here's a documentary. that I've just thought of, but this is a winner. Air fryers versus Ozempic. You give 10 what? People an air fryer, you give 10 people a Ozempic. 1 month, you see who loses the most weight.
Okay, I'd watch.
Yeah.
I'd watch. I think I know the answer, regrettably. Yeah, exactly. It's not the air fryer.
Imagine both.
Yeah, imagine both, yes. But in some senses, it's almost like something like podcasts, which obviously has a low overhead and you can turn around immediately.
Yeah.
And there's something about the spirit of this particular age that responds to that. And so I think that having lent into that, Channel 5, they've done very well with it.
Well, I think it's an object lesson in two things, which is there's an audience which has been forgotten in the sort of rush for youth or rush for relevancy, or, you know, there's that audience that's been forgotten and Channel 5 have not forgotten them, and that audience watches an awful lot of television.
And they watch it on linear.
And they watch it on linear, which is incredible for a channel like Channel 5, who, by the way, the suite of channels have raised their share over the last couple of years, which is unheard of. That's like raising your share of, you know, it's like a Betamax company, like raising market share in the mid-80s. And secondly, it has a very, very lean and linear commissioning process. Two people say yes and it's done. And those people are very good at saying yes or very good at saying no as well. And it's sort of not rocket science in a funny kind of way. When you see a channel that is run in that way for its audience and done in a very neat, very smart way and is making money for people, you think, well, it is doable at a commercial broadcaster. Different channels have completely different issues, of course. But Channel 5, if you wanted to do a template 5 years ago of how they should have run it, it's been run exactly like that. And yeah. I think sometimes we have to give credit where it's due, and there are success stories out there, and Channel 5, so air fryers and Willy Wonka output is one of them.
Well, so that's the Willy Wonka documentary on Channel 5, which I think is this Saturday, March the 16th.
Yeah, I will be watching. Shall we have a quick break?
Let's. And when we're coming back from the break, we're going to talk about Jake Paul versus Mike Tyson.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Welcome back to The Rest Is Entertainment. We've done Oscars, we've done Channel 5 documentaries. What next?
We are doing boxing, or is it boxing? Because it's essentially a YouTuber, Jake Paul, who started on Vine. He's become a massively successful YouTuber alongside his brother, Logan Paul. And he is going to fight Mike Tyson, 58 at the time of the fight. It's going to happen on July the 20th at the home of the Dallas Cowboys.
Dallas.
the AT&T Stadium, Richard. And it will be absolutely massive.
It will be. And it's not his first fight, Jake Paul. He's made it. He, as you say, he started on Vine and, you know, then did lots of YouTube videos. He then sort of pivoted to become a very unsuccessful rapper. He had, by the way, the third most disliked video in YouTube history. His first rap single, which was It's Like Every Day. Third most. And so I looked up the top 10 list. I thought this would be interesting, and it's really boring. The list. It's like beefs and stuff.
Yeah.
But he had the third most disliked. He's made a living on being disliked. And his brother, Logan Paul, who we'll get onto, got into all sorts of trouble. Jake has repivoted into becoming a boxer. The first fight was his brother, Logan, was called up by KSI, who's a British YouTuber. Again, absolutely massive. And Logan fought KSI.
Twice.
And Jake fought KSI's brother, again, in front of an enormous crowd.
But the statistics on that are so absolutely wild, okay? When Logan Paul fights KSI, boxing is mainly sold by pay-per-view tickets. I should say that the Jake Paul and Mike Tyson fight is going to be on Netflix, and we're going to definitely come back to that in a minute. And that's going to be available to all Netflix viewers. But most of it's sold by pay-per-view. When KSI fought Logan Paul, the first fight, there were 2 million pay-per-views, which when you think what people are paying, which is, you know, tens of dollars, it could be $60, it's enormous. The second was 1.2 million pay-per-views. To put that into perspective, when Deontay Wilder fought Tyson Fury, the first fight was 325,000 and the second fight was 850,000 pay-per-view. Now, those are sort of boxing's biggest thing at the time, and this is blowing it out of the water.
Out of the water.
But some of that is a lot of it, and people have made it, obviously, you can imagine the complaints. Even if you don't follow boxing, it doesn't really matter, because you can imagine what people are saying is, this isn't really sport. He's not that good at boxing. He's okay. He's a journeyman. How come he's getting... It's like, well, I'm sorry, but boxing bears a huge amount of responsibility for what has happened here, okay? Boxing, it's like a sport that hates its fans. Why can they not see the matchups they want to see? Why could they have to wait years? I mean, finally, Tyson Fury is going to fight Alexander Usyk, but that's taken so long to happen. And what
also,
people,
it probably won't happen.
Well, maybe it. Well, I think maybe it might now. But you know, that will be the first undisputed heavyweight champion of the world this century, which tells another story to you. Fans don't get to see the matchups they want. It takes forever. It's always talk and it never comes off. And what these YouTubers understand more than anything is attention, eyeballs. They start, you know, a YouTube beef becomes a feud, becomes a fight, yeah. And it all happens and it all actually takes place.
Yeah, and it becomes $40 million.
Yeah, he made, I can't remember what he made last year, and I'm going to probably get this wrong, but it's something like $48 million just for him.
He's one of the top five best paid sports people in the world.
Yeah. And he's not a sports person, except isn't he? I mean, why isn't he? And people are watching these. I mean, when people, you're watching sort of KSI fight and he's not really fighting, but no. It says such a lot that parody of the sport, but it's doing bigger numbers than the sport itself.
Well, boxing really embraced hype very, very early on. That's why Ali was what had been one of the greatest boxers of all time, was the greatest showman of all time. And so hype has always been a thing. Building up hatred before fights has always been a thing in boxing. It's how they market absolutely everything. So Jake Paul just sort of very much leans into it. You know, so it's quite impressive what he does. And, you know, he fought an awful lot of YouTubers first. Yeah. Then he fought an awful lot of MMA fighters who you can outbox. The first time he fought an actual boxer was Tommy Fury. Yeah. So Tommy Fury, relative of Tyson Fury, of course, Love Islander. You've got a Love Islander. If anything sums up culture in this century more than this, I would like to know what it is. A Love Islander and a YouTuber in Saudi Arabia punching each other in the face, and they made $40 million out of it.
Which is way more than other
crazily,
you know,
more
proper fighters.
Well, now, well, Tommy Fury is making more money than Tyson Fury.
Which is ridiculous.
Come on.
But what I will say in his defence, he understands his market, he's very punchable. So he's in the right sport.
Yeah.
But he has put women boxers on his on the same undercard as him. He has poured money, I mean, poured eyeballs, I suppose, onto the cards on which he's fighting. And so he's done a lot for women's boxing. He's trying to unionize them all. He's done a lot for pay. He's tried to come up with these new pay-per-view models that are really fighter-friendly. He's done a huge amount for the sport. And although people sort of hate it, a lot of people in boxing hate it because they think, oh, you know, this is the sweet science, all of this sort of stuff. It's like, yeah, but you've done it to yourselves. You've done it to yourselves. Boxers, as you say, Richard, have always need to be self-promoting. Maybe boxers need to start cultivating own online fandoms themselves. We have got to talk about Tyson because having said all of
Mike
that...
Mike Tyson.
Mike Tyson.
Yes.
Not
Tyson Fury.
We've got to talk...
Which, by the way, if AI came up with the name of a boxer, that boxer would be called Tyson Fury.
Yeah. I find it is depressing. I saw Andrew Tate had said, there's no honour now in knocking someone like that out when they're like 58, and thought, oh God, I really, it pains me to agree with you. But Jake Paul posted some footage of Tyson, which he said was, this is from 2 weeks ago, he's working out in the gym, or am I scared? Yeah, not really, I'm ready to do this. And it is some great footage of Tyson, but as it turned out, fans did sort of OSINT on it and are like, no, this is from 4 years ago. Mm. He's now got sciatica, he's got loads of back problems, he's been pictured using a cane, he's constantly pictured going through airports in wheelchairs.
Using a cane?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's something. Yeah, that's an improvement.
Okay. Yes, yeah. And to walk rather than to be anyone with it. And going through airports in wheelchairs, the plot of Rocky Balboa is Sylvester Stallone, for some reason, age 60, gets back into the ring to sort of, you know, with some self-promoting young fighter. This is pretty grim. I mean, if he knocks out Jake Paul, I'll be the first to be enjoying it. But it's pretty grim to watch us, I don't know, a nearly 6-year-old do this for money. I don't know. I suppose it will depend a lot on the result, but
yeah, I mean, you can,
lots of bad things could happen with this.
Well, you can tell it's bad because even Eddie Hearn thinks it's in bad taste.
Eddie
finally
Hearn
found
Andrew
his limit.
I think this is in very poor taste.
Feels like an unusual move for Netflix to put this on, I would say.
It's
so they're going to be putting it on live as well.
They're putting it on live. Again, we keep talking about Netflix saying, oh, no, no, we don't do live sport. It's like, yeah, but you've just done Nadal and Alcaraz. They have done, they do some live sport. I mean, obviously they're doing the wrestling, as you said. Well, there is there's somebody who is called, his job at Netflix is the VP of non-fiction sports.
Oh, wow.
Non-fiction sports is a real kind of doomsday category, isn't it? But there was someone actually in the Iraq War whose job at the Foreign Office, you could ask for them at the switchboard, was head of story development.
Really?
Yeah. Again,
wow.
Not a great harbinger on any front, I thought, but we'll leave that to the politics podcast. So head of non-fiction sports at Netflix thinks this will be huge. And again, you have to say that if it's going to be made freely available to all Netflix subscribers, then so many people, again,
will be
coming into this sport who on other pay-per-view things would be like, what, $60 for one night? No, I'm not paying that. And it's quite hard to get people in, especially when you don't provide the matchups, as we've said, that they actually want to see.
Well, we had Joshua against Ngannou, and that was all over in two rounds, and it was a mismatch. And again, it was a boxer against an MMA fighter.
I found that quite upsetting.
So I think boxing, that was a weird one. Boxing really does only have itself. I mean, it's never been squeaky clean, let's say, boxing. It's never been sort of...
Breaking news.
Yeah.
And the awful people might have been involved in it.
Yeah, it's rum for them to go, I can't believe someone dodgy has come into our sport.
Yeah.
It's not show jumping. Do you know what I mean?
No. All those
I bet show jumping is dodgy as well.
Yeah,
Yeah.
No, show jumping is quite dodgy too. But one of the other
some show jumpers are not
it's
dodgy.
It's really weird watching that kind of internet, that extremely online sensibility being brought to it. And he, you know, just like when we were talking about Mr. Beast, like he understood how to, he just sat there for ages studying virality and how things went viral. Jake Paul started doing this thing where he said, okay, in the sort of trash-talking pre-match, pre-fight press conferences that they've always had in boxing, okay, but, you know, if you lose, will you have to have I Love Jake Paul tattooed on your middle finger? And this guy, this fighter, has now had to have I Love Jake Paul tattooed on his middle fingers. You know, people saying, will you bet your purse then? If you're so confident, you're saying this to me in the press conference, will you bet your purse then? These huge stunts that then everyone talks about, and all he's studying is like, oh, I see, that's how you work.
Yeah.
This needs to be shaken up. It needs to be disrupted. And he is disrupting in many, many ways. And as I say, the unionization, helping women's boxing, you can't knock it because the sport hasn't done it for itself.
Well, he said, I think his brother was saying that Jake was sort of universally hated and was monetizing that in certain ways. And then I think Jake realized that being universally hated is the best way to make money in boxing. There's no industry better to be hated in. That's where all of the money is. So he leans into it. He gets the crowd to chant F Jake Paul. That's the big, you know, chant at all these things. So, you know, he really leans into it. And as you say, he promoted, it's Amanda Serrano who he promotes, and Amanda Serrano, Katie Taylor, is the biggest women's boxing match of all time, sold at Madison Square Gardens. So he's doing interesting, unusual things. He is not a particularly great boxer. He is not a bad boxer, by the way. He's a lot better than his brother and the other YouTubers. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you can take a punch and give a punch. And he commits. You know,
God,
I'll give him that. He's not sort of
He doesn't do any sort of half measures.
Yeah, he's not a weekend warrior. It isn't really sport. It's a grudge match.
Influencer boxing.
But then that's influencer boxing.
Non-fiction sports.
Yeah, unboxing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unboxing videos, we should call them. But it's a tricky one because ordinarily I would say, well, of course I'll be watching this. Him fighting a 58-year-old man, I don't know if I will. The one thing
I'm sorry to say.
Mike Tyson has been sort of in the Jake Paul camp a little bit over the years. I think he's talked about him in respectful ways.
In headlines for all the wrong reasons. He's had newspapers.
He's had him on his undercard a few times. So I think Mike Tyson is a friend of Jake, if you know what I mean, and whether, if he does have the power to do serious damage, he uses that power. I don't think there's a big hatred there. It's not like Jake has called him out and called him all sorts of names. I think he's, you know...
Yes, it's a very respectful build-up, I must say.
Yes, it's far more, this is, you know, the baddest man on the planet and the greatest fighter who ever lived, and now I got to go in the ring with him rather than I can beat you, granddad, which I suspect would be a slightly less interesting...
Well, we'll see how it turns out.
My God, we will see how it turns
out. It's not till July, so they've got plenty of time to get to that.
If I don't see the fight, I would definitely watch the quick turnaround documentary on Channel 5 afterwards. That I will be watching. But it's interesting, his brother, who we haven't talked about, Logan Paul, I think is sort of wrestles now because I think that's easier than boxing. And he's like the American wrestling champion in WWE. He's the one who got taken off air for, you know, having a video of a live suicide in Japan. And so he's a lot of
on
ways...
On YouTube, this was originally when
YouTube,
he was a YouTuber. That's going back quite a few years
now. In a lot of ways more problematic than his brother, but Logan and Jake Paul, who are very much
Logan Paul and KSI, which anyone who's got children will have been aware of the equivalent of the tulip bubble that's been happening, where they created this drink, an energy drink called Prime.
Oh, yeah.
That has became insane. I mean, people were trying to sell bottles of it for sort of £55. My children told me that one boy in their class in the playground was selling just the caps of it for £2.
Wow.
It's like, God, I mean, really. And these drinks, they sold out. People were queuing. Even a child psychologist that I was speaking to said, yeah, no, I was in the queue at like 6 a.m. outside Asda on a sort of Friday morning so that I could try and get like my two allowed bottles of Prime.
The first headline I saw about it was Prime causes chaos at Asda.
Yeah, it's been unbelievable. And I thought it was going to be this incredibly short-lived bubble. But strangely, it is enduring and it's going on. Because I couldn't understand how they have the infrastructure to actually bring this thing out, which was going to kind of collapse and then no one's going to be interested in it in about 5 weeks. So it's not like being Coca-Cola when you've got a company yeah. and you're a long-term concern. But maybe it has become a long-term concern.
Well, I think
it
has.
Because they're so massive that it's just continued and people are still interested in it, although it's not the mania in the playgrounds anymore at all. It's gone, that.
But I imagine they teamed up with a company who sold soft drinks to do it, who probably had the infrastructure already. I'm not sure I'd trust Logan Paul to actually deliver it himself to be driving up the M1.
No, but you think, oh, well, how can they actually take that much production? Because
yes,
it's becoming so enormous.
Yeah.
But anyway, they managed to do it. And I think it is actually just a sort of, like, it's a new addition to the supermarket shelves and it's there now. But you can actually buy it when you go in rather than everyone buying it and then reselling the bottles for sort of £60.
What a world we live in, don't we? What a gamut. We've gone from royal palaces with Alexander Armstrong to KSI's Prime drink in Asda.
Taking in the Ozempic red carpet. So,
very quick recommendations. Absolutely loved One Day on Netflix. I know I'm not the only person to say that, but it's I took a while before I went in because I love the book so much and absolutely captivated by it. It's brilliant. And I'm a man of a certain age, so the music was incredible, but really beautifully written as well. Very funny. When you realise it's about class and not about romance, it really hooks you in.
Oh, that's very good. Okay, mine is a book which is by a director called Ed Zwick, which is called Hits, Flops and Other Illusions, My 40-something Years in Hollywood. This guy, he TV-wise, he made 30-something, My So-Called Life, movies, Legends of the Four, Shakespeare in Love, Last Samurai, Glory. I mean, he's got an incredible career, but it's the way he writes about the job of being a director, about stardom. I find the way he talks about stars and how humanely he talks about these really otherworldly creatures and how exposed they are when they're making a mega movie and all sorts of things like that. But it's an absolutely fascinating account of his life directing and writing as well. He's written lots of screenplays and I think it's absolutely terrific. So it's called Hits, Flops and Other Illusions and it's by Ed Zwick.
Lovely.
Please join us next week for more of the same. In fact, please join us on Thursday for our questions and answers edition, yeah. Which I finally said the right way.
Oh, well done. Yeah, as Al Pacino would say, my eyes see Oppenheimer.
My eyes.
Yes, we'll see you on. We'll see you for the Q&A. I'm calling it Q&A now.
Yeah, okay. Very cool.
With R.O. and M.H.